Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, a former GE business leader and now founder and CEO of ShoshaWorks, a global advisory firm for ecosystems and organizational transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy, and really reframing the way that we innovate and build for resilient futures. In this series, brought to you by ShoshaWorks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, we're exploring these new ecosystemic models and impacts. And over the next three episodes, we'll be diving deep into scenarios, a global organization's history of scenarios, the potential impact on future planning, and how we can use scenario planning to support greater ecosystemic wellness. My co-host today is James Villarubia from NASA. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Diane. Hello, everyone. I'm James Villarubia. I'm currently a Presidential Innovation Fellow with NASA, where I'm helping the engineers and the scientists use AI to imagine and design better futures for humanity. So I started my career as a statistician and technology policy expert, covering a wide variety of issues at the White House, the DOJ, the DOD. And before joining NASA, I was a technical leader and CTO in several social impact startups, from education and healthcare to banking and cryptography. And I was actually reflecting today, Diane, that in my startup experience, I personally found that a lot of the most successful and innovative startups have to both imagine sort of wholly new futures where their product and service is everywhere, but also be able to clearly express that path or story to get to that future. So given that, I think I'm really excited. It's really a poignant episode to dig in today with our guest to discuss, as you mentioned, the power of scenario building and how we get to these sort of better futures. So back to you, Diane.
Thanks, James. Great points. And we're about to get a masterclass here today. We're thrilled today to be joined by Geraldine Wessing, Chief Political Analyst at Shell. Geraldine, we're just thrilled to have you join us. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Diane and James. I'm really happy to be here today. So yes, indeed, my job title is Chief Political Analyst in the Shell Scenarios team. And so the role and what I do basically is to try and make sense of the geopolitical trends in the world at play today and pull those into the scenario work that we do within the company. But with the territory also comes a really large degree of geekiness around Shell scenario methodology as well. So I would say it's kind of double hatting on the political analysis as well as trying to innovate and continue to work through Shell scenarios methodologies and really apply the mindset and the principles of scenarios in the company as well. So that's really kind of what I do in my personal role. But you asked a question as well about the history of Shell scenarios and where did it all start from? And there's this thing that we do in the team, which is to introduce ourselves as, we're from the Shell scenarios team. We've been doing scenarios for 50 years now. But when we say that's not a mean feat, is it? I mean, that's quite something. And so reflecting on your question, actually, if you can imagine, if you can take yourself back to the 1960s of London, right? I mean, this was a buzzing town, 1960s. But it was also a time where technology was really starting to take off in the computing world. And there's some great footage on the YouTube where you can find Shell Center footage on YouTube where you can actually see the offices in the 1960s. And there are these great big massive computers there, right? Now, this idea of using computers to model and to do financial planning, to do some forecasting, to do predictions really, was really all the fashion in the 1960s. But what the executives actually found is that for a company like Shell then, the business planning cycles were much longer, right, than what these models could actually paint a picture for. So they brought in a couple of people, Jimmy Davidson and Ted Newland. They were brought in to set up this Shell planning department. And their job in 1967, when they were brought in, was quite simple. Think about the long term, right? Just do some thinking, please, about the long term for us. And so that's precisely what they did. So what they tried to understand is if they were to think about what were the great assumptions of the time around continuity to do with their industry, obviously, they were thinking about, well, you've got the Arab oil producing states, and then you've got these massive economies in the West and the US. And it's this kind of one-way traffic, isn't it, really? You've got the oil coming from the Middle East that's feeding this hungry economy in Europe and a hungry economy in the US. It's one-way traffic. So they thought, well, if we were to challenge that assumption, if there was a discontinuity there, what would that do? And so they actually modeled, right, some oil price scenarios. The first set of oil price scenarios were produced in 1971, and they presented that to the senior leadership. But it didn't really land in any particular way. So they were really quite disappointed. And so they brought in, and this is the famous man, right? This is Pierre Vac, and he's actually the man that made the Shell Scenarios team famous. And he came in and he understood that actually what you really need to think about is how you tell the stories of how you get to different scenarios. Because it's no good telling people what they don't want to hear if you're not going to explain plausibly how it could realistically happen. And that's exactly what Pierre Vac did. And so he introduced this concept of the art of reperception, which is really to try and take people on a journey of discovery and get them to see the world in a very different way and accept it as plausible. And so that's what he did. And so the leadership at the time, the committee of managing directors, as they were called, they listened patiently for 3 hours, I'm told, no less. And so in a sense, that was a success. They sat, they listened. Now, they didn't necessarily change anything that day, right? They didn't change the strategy. But they listened well enough that when the Yom Kippur War kicked off in 1973, they were ready to respond quickly and flexibly. And they made quite bold decisions quite quickly. And if you compare Shell's response to its competitors at the time, you might see some of that sort of reflected in those actions, if you like. So that's really actually where it all started, Diane.
That's, I think, the connection of sort of the content expertise that Shell has in this space, as well as the methodological expertise of scenario planning. But I think sort of adding that point is critical for our audience, is that storytelling to actually make sure that it sticks, so that the combination of those three can be pretty powerful. Can you talk a little bit about how, I mean, I know you just mentioned the Yom Kippur War, you talk about maybe some other examples throughout history where these scenarios have had an impact that sort of changed society, or at least have been absorbed better by society, even sort of that storytelling aspect that isn't just a dry report on a website, it's being sort of embraced?
I mean, I can only really speak to what I've witnessed. And actually, interestingly, last year, we witnessed quite a critical event, especially in the energy space with the invasion of Ukraine. And that was also an interesting phenomenon where I think a lot of people may have wanted to resist exploring the possibility of this being first of all, the possibility of an invasion. And secondly, the possibility that this invasion would actually cause ripple effects that would be far beyond expectations, but also for far longer than anybody would really want to believe. So I think there again, the power of the storytelling backed up with tangible, with data, with historical examples of where we've seen this before, with what we understand from the economics, from the energy system and the market dynamics, being able to pull all of that together and really explain the driving forces, the dynamics, and therefore the potential for the different ways that this could be resolved. I think that's been really powerful as well. And what's interesting in that then, James, is that if you can show all the different ways that you believe a situation or a crisis can be resolved, even though all of them are actually uncomfortable realities, even in there, you can actually learn something that across the scenarios that we have, we know this is not going to be resolved quickly. And that's a conclusion that you can then draw, which is really important. And so Shell was also able to respond really rather quickly. And I think that when we've been telling the story, you can see that people start to realize, oh, yes, this is actually a much more complex situation than what we perhaps thought it was and perhaps would like it to be, unfortunately. So actually, yeah, we've really just witnessed another one of these, James, unfortunately, I'm afraid. Yeah.
So I mean, it sounds like then that it's not simply, and this is for our audience, it's not that you predicted the Ukraine invasion, more so that the scenario planning and the exercise of that created awareness of the potentialities so that when something like Yom Kippur War happened or the invasion of Ukraine, that you're able to respond quickly and effectively, and also have the muscle memory to then sort of adapt. Oh, our scenario or context has changed. Let's now build newer scenarios based off of that. So scenario planning as a discipline within an organization is not about just predicting the future. It's about actually being able to respond to the present more effectively. Is that, I mean, that's sort of the, I think the a takeaway here.
I love that, James. That's absolutely right. And just to build on that a little bit further to explain really what we mean by this, in February 2021, Shell actually launched its energy transformation scenarios. And these scenarios were meant to look at what would the world look like as it recovers from the pandemic, because that was another shock to the system, right? That we were grappling with. And we were, when the pandemic hit, we were actually in the middle of producing our energy transformation scenarios. So we had to rethink, well, what we were working on, does it actually now, do we have to now redraw the map? Or actually, can we still work within the parameters, but we need to now feed in the acceleration and the amplification that the pandemic is causing? And that's what we ended up doing. So we launched these scenarios in February 2021, thinking, wow, we've got some really robust scenarios here that cover three different ways we could come out of the pandemic. And they were looking at whether we prioritize growth and really wealth as we come out of the pandemic and try and recover the economy. Do we, in the second scenario, actually recover from the pandemic in a way where we feel more insulated? We want to actually protect ourselves. We want to become more resilient. And so we really focus on our own security. Or do we focus more on the societal well-being? And these were three very different characters, and they really launched us into three different directions in terms of these scenarios. And what the events of February last year actually showed us is that we now all seem to be getting sucked into that second scenario, which we called islands at the time, which is really that security mindset scenario. And so this is not, so these new scenarios, these energy security scenarios that we launched last month, they're not brand new scenarios in the sense that we went to the drawing board and started all over again. We actually took what we already had and learned from it and adapted it to the new situation.
So how much, I think it's fascinating, the evolution, the journey that the scenarios community has been on, right? Initially, you might imagine that you want a better system of knowing, right? And anticipating what the future might hold, right? And what we're hearing here is that is one component, but even perhaps equally or even more important is this system of preparedness and resilience, right? Preparing the community, whether that's the organization or the broader society, creating a system of awareness and contextualization for those potential scenarios as they unfold, what actions can be taken in order to better manage through those pathways. So how much of the storytelling and the change management and the preparedness factors into kind of where your team invests?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, so I get asked the question a lot, why does Shell publish its scenarios? Are you not just, you know, is this not just a strategy tool? Well, it is. And which is, so we use the scenarios that we produce very much to build resilience and also just to promote better decision making. Because fundamentally, the scenarios are based on critical uncertainties that we cannot predict which way these are going to play out. So being able to produce strategy that is resilient against the range of scenarios across the different timelines to a more or less extent is really the name of the game of scenarios in a corporation like Shell. However, there's also a really interesting role to play outside of the company as well, because what the scenarios reveal are real societal dilemmas. And these are not dilemmas that we as an organization alone can also choose to solve. This is not how the world works. But they do reveal those dilemmas and where they are. So we have a duty to share these scenarios so that we can promote conversations to then also work with others, to work with governments and other organizations from different sectors, foundations, think tanks, academia, and talk about these dilemmas and how they should be resolved, or how, again, societies and economies can make themselves resilient against those very same shocks that we believe could happen in the different scenarios. So that's really from a Shell perspective, and that's how we use these scenarios But we also go a level deeper, I would say, because these are global scenarios, right? Now, the energy security scenarios are a little bit special because they also include country level detail. So in an organization like Shell, where we are, we operate on all the continents of the world, and we also focus on the entire energy system, right? So there are really only a few pockets where we don't operate. So for us, it's interesting to then also understand how did the scenarios help really promote resilience at a local level. So not just from the group of Shell companies, but also at a country level. And even there as well, work with the local stakeholders to really explore those bottlenecks or the dilemmas, whatever those teachings of the scenarios, and try and work through them together. So there's also almost like a collaborative element to scenarios. It's not just for your self-interest and your strategic, let's say, challenges and explorations, but it's also really to form partnerships and collaborations and seek to resolve some of these wicked problems.
It's funny you bring up wicked problems. I think when you were talking about sort of the collaboration element, that's one of the issues that faces NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Group. Our project is focused almost entirely on solving these wicked problems. And one of the challenges, I think, understanding of a problem which may have 9 parts, each of which every player has one part of and sees one part of. And I think that's really the compelling part about your reports, is that not only do you have nice branding, oh, it's the island scenario, it's the waste scenario, which is a good hook to sort of emotionally converse around, but there's a lot of depth there to sort of help people have a shared lexicon around the problem. And then, okay, maybe we'll get to a solution, but at least we're talking about the same problems. But given sort of the diversity, as you just mentioned, of collaboration, that this is published, that many countries are involved, I would assume that countries may have sort of different takes, different responses. How has the reception been for some of these scenarios, particularly the more recent ones?
Most recent, yeah. It's a great question, James. So from my personal sort of interactions so far from stakeholders in the different regions of the world, what's been really interesting is that I've found that, let's say, the Anglo-Saxon West, but if I can group a number of countries in sort of the Anglo, sort of the English-speaking Western economies, I would say that they are very hawkish, right? They're very fearful of the geopolitical impact and the trajectory that is perceived at the moment, which is really around the geopolitical rivalry between the US and China. Yeah. And I think that that is prevalent. So when you present these scenarios to those stakeholders, you immediately get, yes, we know it's doom and gloom. And it's quite a pessimistic and it's an anxious time. And this reflects the anxiety that is felt. Whereas if you go to some of the, perhaps, let's say, Latin American countries, I find that there's a very different sense of optimism there. Because when they look at the scenarios, they actually really see opportunities here. Right? They see opportunities for growth in certain commodities, for instance. They see the fact that when you have these great power rivalries, you can sometimes pick and choose your partners, right? And so you can sometimes have more options now than you might have had before in terms of who you trade with, what you trade, and how you also attract industries, because other more previously dominant markets are now perhaps not so attractive anymore. So you get an excitement in Latin America that I sense is interesting. And what is interesting in Asia, of course, is that you get very different. I think Asia is a very different sort of set of markets as well, where you have, again, the emerging economies are very excited about the prospects of growth and attracting investment, leapfrogging in the energy transition, really becoming really industrializing, but through clean energies as well. So they see a lot of prospects for growth. And then you see others who are very deliberately not talking about, let's say, the geopolitical rivalry, right? So in China, for instance, you know, that we don't talk about it. It's a very different focus. It's about China's growth, right? It's about China's domestic growth. And so I find it really interesting. Like you say, the scenarios cover such a broad range of issues and driving forces and topics that in each of these regions and countries, they're picking up on things that they recognize and that they feel very close to. But even within these countries, they're flip-flopping, right? So they recognize some bits and then they're also, but actually I also see the signals of something else happening that I perhaps am a bit more worried about. So I would say, if I was to generalize, those would be my generalizations so far, James, I would say. But yes, we've only just launched them. So maybe ask me again next year and I'll give my better update.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
It's a great, if you kind of abstract the kind of the problem, the wicked problem landscape, right? That you are really solutioning within. It's a great, and come back to this masterclass concept, right? It's a great parallel to how markets work, right? And just understanding the broad, very dynamic and complex landscape of wicked opportunities and wicked problems, and how important it is to understand not only the problem landscape and the potential future scenarios, but also the motivations and the aspirations of each of the actors within that landscape. Right. What you just described in terms of these archetypes sets a really interesting stage for both opportunity and peril, or opportunity and risk, that understanding those motivations a little bit more deeply and how they're evolving can help the different participants in the system make better decisions. So you really need to maintain a pretty consistent and vigilant view of what's going on in the world in order to establish a more resilient posture as changes roll through. So I know we're running a little bit short on time today, and we will be continuing this conversation. This has been so incredibly fascinating. We love the work that you and your team are doing, Geraldine, and the many lessons that we can take away. But for me, I think the key takeaway for me and James, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, but just that masterclass and having a very kind of strategic point of view regarding how a change is flowing over markets, how it could show up in the next 5, 10, 50 years for society and industry, and how that cascades down into real world implications for the various actors in that system, and just how we can together share information and make better decisions together for ecosystemic wellness. James, your thoughts, your key takeaways from the discussion today?
Yeah, I totally agree on your takeaway, Diane. I think the thing that is going to stick in my brain for a while is the story around sort of the early days of this scenario planning and how impactful the storytelling component ended up being in sort of the formation success of this group within Shell. Because I think that really ties back to what we were talking about at the end around, if this is a shared lexicon, it needs to be believable. It needs to be not just dry and factual, that the ability to convince and ability to sell an idea, a concept, and have people embrace it is pretty critical to scenario building. And I think those sort of two bookends of sort of the narrative here have been really interesting to tie together in my brain. So thank you so much, Geraldine, for sharing with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Geraldine, thank you so much. And to our listeners today, please be sure to check out the next two podcast episodes, where we'll continue this conversation and we'll talk about the different options that scenarios can introduce and how we can use this knowledge and this capability to design for greater ecosystemic wellness. So please follow us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access your podcast, and you can learn more at shoshimworks.com.